Hi, I'm Sharad Kitten, and welcome to Let's Talk, the show that brings you the most important conversations of the day. Today we look at an opinion piece that was published in Free Malaysia Today, which has gotten many sitting up in their seats. Tajuddin Rusty is a professor of architecture at UCSI University. His essay is titled The Illusions of Power in Post-Reformasi Malaysia. Together with me, he's joining us, and Tien Chua, Vice President of Parti Keadilan Rakyat, or PKR, former two-term MP of Batu. Thank you so much, gentlemen, for being here.
Yeah, thank you.
Practitioner and critic, I think maybe is one way of putting it. This piece that you wrote was on the heels of the anti-ICERD protest. You call it a kind of turning point. Why was it for you so significant, a moment in the post-May 9th period?
Well, I have been watching the events after the election. I've been following the Reformasi for 20 years, you know, and after the May 9th election, then we had two by-elections, and I'm monitoring the Malay votes very carefully. How is it going to be turning or not? And the suspicion there that it's not going to be turning, okay, because there's deep-rooted problems about the narrative of Islam, the narrative of Malay. This is the thing. And being in academia, and I keep telling this, and not many people like it in the public universities, but the problem lies there, in the public universities, where this narrative is carried by the public universities.
Right. So before we get into the question of the role of the universities, and because you mentioned this in your piece as well, the question of the anti-ICERD protest, of all the things that we've seen of pushback on the agenda that the Pakatan Harapan government has, why is the anti-ICERD protest significant for you?
Well, if you look at the manner in which the protest had taken on a life of its own, it was through these WhatsApp messages that I have been monitoring from several of the WhatsApp group that I have. I don't really participate in this group that I have in the smartphone. My wife is the one who usually does that, and she would say this, she would say that. And I notice a lot of this. I mean, our WhatsApp group are like head teachers, you know, school teachers, and also we have people who have gone to overseas coming back. These are mostly Malays, and it's going wild, you know, certain things which certain people putting up very simplistically. There's no attempt at reading the ICERD and understanding it fully. It's just the sentiment that just went way out.
Okay, so it was the run-up to the protest rather than the protest itself and numbers. Tien, for you, was the protest significant? Because the numbers, you know, by all estimates, was as big as the Bursay protest. It seemed very well organized.
Yeah.
Were you surprised, and was it significant to you?
I'm not surprised. I think, for me, the protest symbolised, I mean, contrary to many people, it symbolised the new Malaysia. A new Malaysia that tolerates voices that is not consistent with the government, or in fact, undertone, which is a strong critics, a strong protest. To me, it is a protest against the government, not so much against ICERD as such. It is also an important landmark because it showed that in the new Malaysia, despite people who support the government feel uncomfortable with it, we have to face the fact that people will disagree with us. We also have to undergo certain anxiety because a lot of people, especially non-Malay and the liberal crowd, started to worry that would there be a riots and things like that. I joke about it. I say that's the same karma that we had when we had Bursay. I'm sure people on the other side at that time, UMNO's supporter, were equally anxious about what it would turn out to be. Would there be a riot? Would there be a turn into an anti-government protest? Would the government prematurely being pulled down by the mass protest, etc., etc.? Today, the same thing happened. But I think this is what we have to live with.
Okay, so you put a rather positive spin on this moment. Some might actually say, or your critics might say, that this was a failure of communications by the Pakatan.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think, first of all, I think the issues was brought up prematurely. There was no public education. People who agree and disagree with it both have not read the thing. We can go to the street, you ask people, you support SAC, they only hear elimination of racial discrimination. If they feel that they are target of discrimination, they will say yes. And we also misled majority of public, especially Bumiputra, to believe that affirmative action is a form of discrimination. And their rights and their existence in this country was based on the system which is racist, which is not true. I mean, so ended up you have people who defend it and thinking that they are defending a form of racist policy, which is not true. Our constitution is not racist. Mm-hmm. Our constitution does not embody discrimination, which to the effect that disadvantage people or to oppress others. So, I mean, these are the things that which created uneasiness, and the old conflicts, the old maneuver came back. But as I said, a new government must face with it. We cannot think that we have won with the majority and therefore those issues will just go away by itself.
All right, okay. Actually, there's a big thread to this discussion, which is the question of majoritarian rule in this country and so on and so forth. But let's keep to Tajuddin's article, The Illusions of Power in Post-Reformatic Malaysia. You used this moment to launch a broad criticism of the Pakatan government, saying that it did seem to understand the reality of power in post-Reformatic Malaysia. Actually, you take us back 20 years, don't you, Tajuddin, saying that the outbreak of the Reformasi movement in the late 90s really started the shift in the way power is designed or has, you know, has structured itself.
Yeah.
Could you tell us a little more about what your argument is?
Well, if you look back 20 years ago, I couldn't even imagine that the Barisan National Government could be toppled. I thought I would be dead before that thing happened, or it wouldn't even happen. Because knowing the Malay society and the strength of the authoritarian rules of that nature. But when I look at Malaysia Kini coming up in the early days, and then the Malaysian Insider, I mean the news portal, I mean, at that time we followed Mahazalim and all this Mahafira and Raja Petra. Yeah. That was the really... So you could see that Raja Petra in his Mahazalim portal control massive influence, and this is the one that began. And then you got the forums, people putting up forums because that's the alternative thing to the television. Okay, so people were not watching that. And then only came the smartphone after that. And it just went on and on and on. And I was quite surprised, in fact, that the government actually toppled after 20 years. So the scene has been set. And then I thought, okay, I also thought like, okay, now it's time to be the government. Let's go shake hands, go and take pictures, press statement, that sort of thing, go to meeting room. But then when I saw that happening, and then the before the ICERT thing, there were other things, okay? And I see that, hey, this is something funny going on around here. So we cannot be doing the same thing that Barisan National ministers were doing, except maybe play golf. But they were doing the same thing. They were just having all these kind of identities of power kind of a thing.
Okay, I just want to quote from Tajuddin's article. It says, what are the new ministers doing to change Malaysia? Attending meetings, making press statements, appearing on Astro Wani, posing for Bitahari and Utusan, making speeches. The list goes on. And this is not a positive list. This is a list of what you think is not right about the way in which Pakatan Harapan...
Well, partially positive.
Yeah. Okay, well, okay, we're going to pick this up in the next segment. Stay, hold that thought. We'll be back shortly. Stay tuned to Let's Talk with me, Sharad Kutin. Hi, and welcome back to Let's Talk. I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Atien Chua, Vice President of Parti Keadilan Rakyat, also a former MP of Batu, as well as Tajuddin Rusty, Professor of Architecture at UCSI University. He's the author of an article we're trying to get our heads around, The Illusion of Power in Post-Reformasi Malaysia. Quite an interesting article because you note a real sea change for the way politics operates in this country. And Tajin, I want to quote from you. You say, the Barisan government lasted for 60 years because the times were different. First, there was no democracy. Secondly, they had the police to run Operasi Lalang or launch commando raids on Anwar Ibrahim's house. Thirdly, there was only RTM and TV Tiga. So you kind of set the stage for what's actually changed. And you're saying, and reflecting on the anti-ISED protest, that you think this government and many of its members assume that the conditions that were there for Barisan Nasional continue for the Pakatan Harapan government. Could you elaborate?
Well, just to be very frank, I also assume the same thing. You know, I said, well, let's stop being the opposition and let's start being government. And government being the culture of what ministers, laws are made by some discussions in meeting rooms and then policies are made, then you make your press statement and things goes on, nice, hunky-dory and things like that. But apparently, the new culture, when we were in the reformacy, that was the culture. Yeah. We didn't have any other culture at all. And going to ceramah and in the fields and things like that. And so when the new situation after May 9th, we begin to see that the so-called opposition party picking up, maybe accidentally, I'm not sure, but they are maybe cyber troopers are still working overtime or something like that. But it's making its impact very, very thoughtful.
Right. Okay. So you've actually, in your article, pointed out to the power of social media in shaping people's sentiments. But Tien, you know, the government that you support, is there? Do you think there's this binary opposition in government? Is that the way to operate?
I think the opposition government's line has been blurred now, and which is what expected. And this is the whole point about democracies that we are bringing about. Currently, there is certain even more clarity. It's even more difficult to see when on the other pole, the opposition themselves and have not worked out how an opposition should be. Yes, rightly so. I mean, what Prof said is that when we were elected as government, there were expectations that you had to do the cutting ribbon, you had to do the press conference, you had to attend cabinet meeting, you had to give briefing to civil servants and things like that. I mean, that's the I would use a word, the ritual of commanding power. I mean, you must continue because otherwise the society cannot function and the society also have to see those rituals continue and to give the sense that things are in order. I mean, that's what all state rituals is about. I agree very much that today decisions, public opinions are shaped not through those standard operation and procedure, not through press statement that issues or law that being amended in the parliaments, etc. Public opinions are shaped by social media and shaped by actors who have vested interests, and everyone is asserting their interest now. And whether something is become catching fire or not, it is a question of trust.
Okay, and we'll come back to the issue of trust, and maybe the trust deficit was something that the Najib administration suffered quite significantly.
Yeah.
The issue here, is it purely about perception? Isn't policy still very important as a tool
yes,
for shaping
I think policy,
sentiment ultimately?
Policy is important, but the issue is the making of policies require two things. One is the thorough understanding of the policy and its impact. You know, the new government and my colleague has to be mindful that it cannot be going into pushing a policy because it was our traditional belief, our traditional principle that we have defended for 20 years, 30 years. It cannot be a policy that because you want to make yourself or your supporter feel good. So policy must actually entail a total understanding of those policies, what will be the impact on the society. I think this is still lacking. I mean, there is not enough study, not enough critical thinking into it.
Yeah, in fact, some of the criticism isn't that you know, the ministers and cabinet are just merely cutting ribbons. They're not concerned about public perception. Yeah, yeah. In fact, that they are far too concerned about public perception, maybe speaking too much to the media and not doing the kind of evidence-based policy formulation work behind closed doors. I mean, would you take that as a valid criticism of the government of the day?
I think the idea of the new government having to understand, first and foremost, that the weapon that you had created can be used by the enemy.
Okay, so that I get, right? Yes. So the weapon is social media and creating a certain
feeling. So the fault there lies is that once you, quote-unquote, won the battle, then you just forgo that weapon and put it somewhere else. But that weapon has already been found by the enemy and is being built up considerably.
Do you think that's true, Tien, that in many ways the political parties, never mind the cabinet, but the political parties are not doing the groundwork, they're not invested in social media and changing perceptions?
I wouldn't totally say so. It's just that position change, and to some extent, yes, there's a lot more rooms out for the more traditional medias and, you know, TV station, RTM and all these things, given more space to the ruling parties and people who are associated to the ruling parties. And the social medias have been lacking because, I think back to the issues of communications, this is a composite government with different ideology. The internal cohesiveness is yet to be built. Right, so the communication between different segments of the government where they have different form of ideological understanding of the situation is not cohesive enough. I think we require more time to work on it. And therefore, this gap being filled out by people who just basically mistrust the government.
Okay, and, so this is not just your political rivals, but just generally the mistrust.
And our political rival exploit on that mistrust to gain momentum and to get supports in the mass mobilization.
Okay, we're going to come back. Hold that thought. We're going to go for a break. We'll be back with Let's Talk. Yeah. Stay tuned.
Hi, and welcome back to Let's Talk with me, Sharad Kutin. My guest today, Tajuddin Rusty, a professor of architecture at UCSI University, and the subject of our discussion tonight, his essay, The Illusions of Power in Post-Reformasi Malaysia. I've invited Tien Chua, PKR Vice President and former Batu MP, to debate this. Actually, very interesting and very productive article that you've written. In it, used an expression, gravy train. So you're saying, and I use it because it's often made as part of a criticism. We saw it in the ANC in South Africa as well, and I think Desmond Tutu very famously talked about the gravy train, that the ANC members, having now dismantled apartheid, then wanted to get onto the gravy train. They wanted the titles, they wanted the privileges, they wanted the nice cars, and they wanted the pomp and ceremony. Do you think the issue of the gravy train, that Pakatan workers or MPs or politicians are getting on that gravy train, is something that most Malaysians believe, that they're now, having power, are going to seek out the same sort of privileges that the Barisan Nasional sought for itself when it was in power?
Well, I'm going to have to be really frank this time, because when we look at the composition of Pakatan Harapan, we find that there are people, I'm just going to be direct here, like PPBM, coming in not from the 20 years of struggle. Okay, so we also have some issues about, this the deputy chief ministers or deputy minister, the issue of the, the sexual harassment or something like that. I think it was in the... So I'm wondering, who are these assistants? Where are they coming from? And then the Menteri Besar Johor, I think PPBM, saying some controversial things in the very early part of his ministership. And I think these are...
So not problems. Acting very different from Barisan Nasionalist.
Because they were not different at all. I mean, I don't see them as being different because they come from the same basket, okay, before. And so we needed, you know, PPBM to prop up the Malay thing, Malay influence and all that. But then of course you have to bring in these people, and so this is the one of the issues.
Well, these people are actually comrades, as it were, comrades in arms in overturning or dismantling the Barisan Nasionalist in terms of Najib.
No, I'm sorry, I did not like that. They were rats running away from the sinking ship.
Okay, well, that's interesting. So, Dean, how do you see this? Because PPBM played an extraordinarily important role in the breakthrough in May 9th. Is it now, can we now turn around and say, well, they're actually all UMNO and they're bringing their culture over to
I think we have, it's a bit too simplistic to say that they are all UMNO. Yes, I mean, they are elements of things that are negative and we have to eliminate. Whether they are in UMNO or whether they are in Keadilan or whether they are in Amanah or any other party. And some perpetuate problems in terms of when you give power to people and power tend to corrupt. So whether they are UMNO or not, that has to be, we have to be mindful of.
But do you think, do you remember there was, I want to draw your attention to, there was a very interesting campaign in the run-up to the general election that said, coming from the Barisan National side, actually, they're not very different. Pakatan and Barisan National are not really that different.
Yeah, this is why I think that that perception is created for no change. But definitely, we have the change. And then the change already happened. The issues is now no longer, I don't think we should still entangle ourselves into whether Pakatan is the new UMNO or UMNO 2.4, 2.1 or 2.2 or whatever, which is, to me, quite a meaningless discussion. The real issues is that whoever it is, the old reformist who has invested 20 years sacrifice now get into the gravy train, they are equally problematic and we equally need to monitor than those people who used to be from UMNO and they joined yesterday. So the issues is the power structure and how do we as a society and also as new government to ensure that people who hold power are not corrupted.
Okay, so to put that
blame to say, oh, this is an old UMNO culture, we are talking as if that those old reformists who have been on the street, once they get onto the gravy train, they will be more pure than those people who just run across there. So I say, no, it's the same.
Okay, right. I take your point, but Tajuddin, you know, in your circles, when you reflect on the this current government, do you see the same things emerging? Are you worried that they're not acting fast enough or more assertive about problems of corruption or abuse of power or this love of pomp and ceremony? Those kinds of things. Do you think they're not acting in as a concerted way as you know as they should?
I think most of the Pakatan Harapan cabinet ministers I trust. Okay, this is a few I don't trust. Okay, now the ones I don't trust very easy. Those which did not come from the reformasi mold. Same thing with Islam in the olden days. Those that came in when the Prophet liberated Mecca. This one. Not as with the other ones who had struggled with the Prophet. So I think their problem is not understanding the new battleground. That's all. I mean, it's an innocent. I don't think they want to be pomp. I don't think they relish in the idea of all this limousine. But of course, you get used to it. And corruption, it takes a bit longer, I mean, not as fast as the those who have already done it before. But the point here is that they are very honest. Is it like Mujahid, Mazdi? You can see that they are working very, very hard.
And you mentioned them in your article.
Yes, but the point here is that when they start making statements, especially about the press, and they keep blaming the press for misquoting. I have never really read where the new media are being misquoting. Because I know you got your YouTube, you listen to that. The one that are misquoting utusan and that's for proper propaganda. But the media do not misquote. So the point is that you had made statements which you didn't thought through, like the LGBT issues and all that. And you blame. You are attacking. You attack the media. The media which helped change the landscape of the country and the election. You are treating them as an enemy. Now,
do you take that criticism?
I think we have to stop blaming the media. Well, if we are misquoted, probably the way we use or articulate has a problem. I agree that we have to be more careful, and this is part of the learning process. Think carefully to before you articulate.
You can always
if not, you just issue statement when you write through.
It was reported that the black shoes was important. Those are important. However, I have said, that's not to say the reporters are trying to sensationalize. I get that from academics also. When I said that, look, academics must not engage with society. Anyway, the society is paying your salary. And they said, well, the media, they just want to sensationalize and then sell their newspapers. And they don't know the
media. It's their job, I think. We can't blame the media for sensationalization because they want to sell the newspaper.
Okay, we're going to come back. We'll have to take a short break. We'll be back with more. Stay tuned to Let's Talk with Misha Rajkutan. Welcome back to Let's Talk. I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Tajuddin Rusty, a professor of architecture at UCSI University and the author of a compelling essay on new politics in Malaysia, The Illusions of Power in Post-Reformasi Malaysia, and with us, Tien Chua, PKR Vice President and two-term MP for Batu. He's also a stalwart of the Reformasi period. Reformasi promised, among many things, a democratic Malaysia, a break from its authoritarian past. The paradox seems to be today that democracy is allowing for all kinds of voices, including those that went on the streets and rallied very recently, the anti-ISED protests. Many people who supported Reformasi who actually were opposed to this government's decision to allow the anti-ISED rally to carry on. What do you think is happening there in our minds?
Those people who were critical for us to allow this rally to go on are not supporting democracy. They support Parti Keadilan, they support PBBM, they support DAP. Their attitude towards dissidents is the same as those Barisan Nasional attitude towards us previously. So for us to stand firm, to say that, yes, I don't like their voice, I disagree with them, I totally don't think that they are on the right track, but I have to respect there were enough people, whether they are majority or they're minority, each of us can go and claim, but we must tolerate that. We must allow the space for those people who are disagreeing with us.
What did you think was happening, Tajuddin? You must have heard people, liberals, secularists, people who believe in democracy, but also counselling a clampdown on the anti-ISED protests.
Well, actually, I don't really follow much about the news about some people saying that. I always thought that it was going to happen. I couldn't in my mind that the numbers, how much is the numbers, and are they going to say, those very bad words or not? These are the two things that I wanted to monitor. But just to say, after the election, among the relatives that I know, they haven't changed, in terms of looking at the cash coming out from Najib's house. They haven't changed.
That hasn't changed the perception
of UMNO. They still love UMNO and all that. And until this time, only voices like Khairi and 102 really putting down Najib and now Zahid Hamidi and all that.
Okay, so what is the limits then, Tien, in terms of, tolerance for dissent? How far do you think the population,
especially those who are supportive of Pakatan and the parties, will allow you to be tolerant, give space?
I think this is a test of the maturities of the society. Someone who, like me, I believe in democracy, I think we should uphold this. And to me, the price of suppressions will be even bigger. It doesn't matter whether those people who support the anti-ISIS, or I would not rather classify them as anti, those people who are not comfortable with the current government policies, whether they are 30% or they are 48 or they are 52. It doesn't matter. The point is the legitimate legal avenue for dissent must be there in order to ensure stability.
But what about those who promote an exclusivist view of the Malaysian society, who are racist?
Again, we are again the societies can disagree with them, but the voice should be heard, whether they are minority or not. We do not allow any regime to prejudge or preemptively say that your voice is against public interest, therefore you're not allowed to have rally.
Do you agree?
So, yeah.
Well, yes, I'm always against public opinion.
yeah.
Because a lot of the views that I hold on Islam, on my own readings and all that, are not mainstream at all.
Right. Yeah. In fact, I'm going to use that as a moment to plug this book, your upcoming book, Not the Islam I Know, which is going to be published very shortly. That's a subject for another show.
So the you can use all the bad words to describe another race, and that's part of democracy. Only your society and your religious, the people who said they are religious, and the so-called academics are the one who's supposed to say, look, you shouldn't have been saying those words.
You know,
so it's about social control.
But
if you threaten people, now that one,
that's different.
But what about this government's record on the Sedition Act? We told they were going to have a moratorium, and then there seemed to be confusion. It was used against Papagomo, who's an activist with UMNO. So what's happening there? Why is the Sedition Act still being used?
I cannot speak on behalf of the Home Minister. Yes, the commitment of removing Sedition Act is there, and it will continue. I think the next Parliament next year will deal with it. The Sedition Act will be removed. This is our promise. The usage of Sedition Act was in the view that what certain individual has done threatened social peace. I don't want to prejudge that. This is the opinion of the KDN, the opinion of the police. That's right. Currently, I think if we examine what Papagomo say, there's a certain elements of violence that's been provoked, inciting of that. That was the edge, and there was the. I think when the Sedition Act will remove certain portion of things that the borderline will be incorporated in the new law under the CPT. So I think the considerations of the current situation is that the police, without having the amendment, they only have Sedition Act left to deal with. I'm not necessarily agreeing with this position, but what I would only say that the ruling government did not and will not stray away from the removal of Sedition Act.
Okay. Well, put a cap on that and come back to the ideas that you have, suggestions to the Pakatan government and the political parties for how to deal with the next couple of years while they're in government. Stay tuned to Let's Talk with Misharat Kutin. Welcome back to Let's Talk. I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Tajuddin Rusty, Professor of Architecture at UCSI University, author of the essay that is the subject of our discussion, The Illusions of Power in Post-Reformasi Malaysian. With me also, Tien Chua, PKR Vice President. There are words of advice that you give, Tajuddin, to the Pakatan Harapan government
comes in two expressions, opposition mode and education mode. Mm-hmm. Is that correct? Is that
yes,
the two things?
That's right.
Explain what you mean by that.
Well, I think our citizens need a lot of education. I think if I'm speaking for my own race, the Malays, they need a lot of education. They're worried about a lot of things, and these are justified because they have been fed, I would call, misinformation from my perspective. So I think education is key, and I have been writing so much about it, and particularly I'm particularly harsh on the universities because they have not been doing the real job of educating for nation building.
Okay, so education is the non-contentious element. Opposition mode, now that's a little more contentious.
Okay, now the opposition mode means that you've been doing the groundwork which had been proven to be quite good in terms of influencing the public opinion. For instance, the forums, you know, you have to have the forums. And if you don't have the ministers who are too busy to come down, then you have to have the second or third level party leaders who's going to aspire to take over. They have to be cutting their teeth on this kind of matter. That's why I said pull out the Rafizi truck and start moving. Let the party people and
so you want them to be in a kind of campaign mode. You want them to bring the energy of the election campaign to kind of everyday life.
Because there are issues on the ground which is very, very volatile. And if you don't deal with that issue, it's going to affect the country for a long time. And religious is one of the main issue, and Malay positions and all this need to be re-educated and being done in this all this ceramah kelompok business and things like that.
Is that possible, Tian? You know, when you think about the fatigue, people are willing to do all that and have that kind of energy output when it comes close to elections because it's a once in 5 year thing.
I think Professor's advice very, what is it called, in a positive light, because I would take it on the more the policy level. It is not about winning. I think the so-called campaign trucks or this thing is only about changing power position, you know, from this prime minister to another prime minister, from this party to another. We are not talking about that. If we want to implement certain policies, I agree. Don't assume that because we have a majority in parliament, therefore you draft a nice law and you put into it, you'll get carried. Yes, you will get carried. But the point is, we have to take the assumption that there are nearly half of the population may not agree with us. Mm-hmm. If we don't go on a campaign mode, then you are waiting to accumulate. They will say, okay, this one I get passed. Next one that I don't like, it will get passed. At some point, they will pick up an issues that they will explode, and that's a problem. So I think this is the point that it is important advice, and by just pushing it through the papers works in the bureaucracies, the AG chambers, the parliament, yes, you get your numbers, you get through because the numbers are fixed. And but the point now is that the public itself, we come in with the mandate of change, but the mandate was given to us in a very narrow sense to interpret into a broader reform in the total structure. We require more campaign, we require more public education.
Right, so moving, shifting the ground, persuading people of this, the need for a shift in values. Yeah. Tajuddin, you mentioned in particular the role of universities, is saying the government should actually support academics, but there are a lot of academics currently in the universities, the public universities and private universities, that are very status quo, meaning they were pro-Barisan National, very conservative in their thinking, and probably will push those same values. Should the government of the day be supporting all those academics who for decades were part of the Barisan National gravy train?
Well, I think the idea about them supporting the Barisan National is not really true in that sense. I think many of them support the opposition in the public university. My problem with the public university is the what we call the raison d'être, you know, the reason for being of an academic. To an academic now, the reason for being is to get you yourself promoted, you get the way to do that, to get your grants, you get your journal. So it's a self-serving game. But I'm taught in Islam, if you have little knowledge, you have to spread it. You know, that's how it is. And when you die, whatever that you have spread, you still get the rewards from it. I mean, don't call me religious or anything like that, but I do believe, what's knowledge if it doesn't change your society first?
Right. And so this would be part of a game plan. Your proposal is for the government of the day to be enabled, perhaps, to in fact infuse energy into civil society, make links with civil society and the media.
I mean, for instance, like books and journals. Now, you want to get promoted, if you write in Bahasa Melayu, forget it. You know, if you want to get promoted, you don't publish your journal papers overseas, pay 3,000 ringgit, forget it. No, why should you do that? I mean, you've got journals in the country, and you must change the KPI to say that, look, public first, the world nanti dululah. You know, this is what I've been practicing all my life.
Okay. Yeah. So how do we're coming back in the remaining time that we have to the question of political parties rethinking their strategy in the next 4 years, especially for Pakistan.
No, I think it's not so difficult because, as Professor said, we came from that tradition. I think the reminder was useful that don't get buried into our new tasks and the new idiosyncrasies. And
the rituals
of governance. That's important. We cannot neglect and run away from it. But at the same time, our tradition, where we were rooted in, I think the four parties has a certain degree of understandings of those things that shift ground. And we have to continue. And
but do you think it's going to happen? So the question is, you think it's a good idea, but will it actually happen?
I think it will happen because it can happen also because the election campaign machinery is virtually intact, right? It's just like why PAS can mobilize because it was intact, despite they didn't win the government, central government, but their machinery of mobilizing people to the street is intact. Similarly, in Keadilan, in DAP, in PBBM even, or Amanah, the ability to command social media and to get into their grassroots is there. Currently, I think the problem is the top leaders that have been given tasks in the government often announce and often engage the public without first using their machinery to run through and let people understand why why do you want to ratify ISET. And if our member themselves do not understand and they do not know how to go down the coffee shop and start talking about what 1MDB was about, and then suddenly it was thrown out in the media and the other side attacked, and our ground doesn't know how to defend. So that's the main problem. I think this often happens. Progressive policies, good things, and you throw it out, and our people are not being briefed why ministers say this, and they themselves will be swamped by the same social media state which is going against us.
Right.
So that's,
right. And so as Tajuddin sort of rightly puts that, it's still the top-down approach and a denial of the strength that came from a bottom-up approach that happened during the Royal
Now, I just want to say one thing about financing this thing.
We unfortunately have run out of time, we're going to come back. We're going to bring you back on for the next show, and we'll expand your ideas. We'll probably want to talk about this book, Not Is the Islam I Know. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for being here tonight.
Thank you.
Okay, I've been speaking to Professor of Architecture, Tajuddin Rushdie, from UCSI University. He's the author of an essay titled The Illusions of Power in Post-Reformation Malaysia, and also Tien Chua, Vice President of PKR. This has been Let's Talk with Mishra Akutin, only on Astro Awani.